Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person, too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Norman Lear with my great sidekick, Paul Hipp.
Good to be here with you, Norman, on All of the Above.
That's the name of my podcast, All of the Above.
Yeah.
We have had guests you cannot believe.
Yeah.
Guests.
Julie Louis-Dreyfus, amazing.
Yes. And America Ferrera.
Jared Carmichael.
Yes. Oh, Amy Poehler. How did we overlook? We didn't overlook Amy Poehler. I was saving her for last. And Charles Barkley, I was saving him for first, actually, because I didn't declare up first.
I get to hang out with this guy. And this is your chance to hang out with Norman Lear a little bit here and some of these great guests.
God, I wish I was you hanging out with Norman Lear.
Yeah.
Son of a gun.
See?
That must be exciting.
It's the best. I'm telling you.
Don't miss All of the Above with Norman Lear. The first episode's available Monday, May 1st on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or PodcastOne.com.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt on Podcast One. This is Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on. Mandate, get on. Welcome to Reasonable Doubt. I'm Adam Carolla. Best hour in the universe. Mark Garagus.
Absolutely.
Mark is on site. Where are you, Mark?
I'm in Atlanta working on, have you heard of the Big Three Basketball League that Ice Cube and Quanowitz started? I'm helping with that. So Iverson's in, Dr. J's in, all kinds of guys are in. So we're putting something together, and I stopped in Atlanta to lend a hand.
So they were like, what are we missing? We're missing an Armenian Jew. Let's get Garagus in here. He knows hoops. All right, so you're putting out. We have a guest.
Only three of them in the world, so that's all right.
That's Jim Zirin.
Zirin.
Sorry. Yeah. Oh, Zirin.
Yeah.
Oh, Zirin. I screwed that up.
Exactly.
Sorry. It's spelled a little differently than it's pronounced. But I have a phonetic version of it here, but it's not. It still doesn't exactly make Zirin. Either way, Jim Zirin.
Zirin's got a book out, too. Jim, what is it?
Supremely Partisan.
See, Adam has all the answers. Yes, it's called Supremely Partisan.
Look at that. I mean, Adam wrote it, probably. Did he ghostwrite it for you?
Right. Mm-hmm. He might have ghostwritten it for me. No, I don't. As I remember it, I wrote it myself.
Okay, good.
Best recollection.
We'll get into that. Now, Gary just came in here, and Jim just pushed his microphone away. Is that what you're looking for?
No.
I didn't get the feeling. He usually pulls it up into people's. Up into people, so you can
How's
slide
that?
It.
Is that better?
The closer, the better. Whatever I'm doing, I would say if you did it, right? Not in life. Just in terms of the microphone.
I'll just follow your lead.
So tell us about the book.
The book is about partisanship on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's become a political court, particularly in recent years. It really represents, in certain core issue cases, the personal predilections and policy choices of the justices, rather than anything that's specifically found in the Constitution. That's the basic argument of the book. I kind of got interested in this issue because, I mean, abortion is, of course, almost a defining political issue of our time. And in the year 2000, 5-4, and there were a lot of 5-4 decisions and 6-3 decisions, usually reflecting the conservative majority. And in the year 2000, there was a late-term abortion decision when Justice O'Connor was on the court, and they held that a ban in Nebraska, I think it was, of late-term abortion that had no out for an abortion to save the life of the mother was unconstitutional. And so that was the law of the land for 7 years. Then Justice O'Connor retired, and Justice Alito came on. And involving the same statute out of the D.C. Circuit, they held it was constitutional, even though there was no out to save the life or the health of the mother. So well, it raised the question for me that if changing judges changes the law, then what is the law anyway?
Well, can it go any other way? I mean, given the human factor, you know, where you just take human beings and they have thoughts and they have preferences and they have leanings and some are God-fearing and some are atheists, and you go, make a decision, but please leave all of your personal stuff out of it. Well, is that even is that possible?
Yes.
I was going to say to Jim is I haven't read the book. I really want to. They just sent it over. Judy just sent it over. But the do you get into the fact that, you know, that there's the textualist or there's the originalist, but all that is just window dressing for I'm going to rule the way I want to rule?
Well, it's not quite window dressing because I think if Scalia made any contribution is the revival of originalism that, you know, let's look at the text of the Constitution and what it says. Let's look at the original understanding of the society at the time of the Constitution and then look at the decided cases, how judges in the past have treated these issues. And then make a judicial lawyer-like decision. Now, often it isn't possible to do that because, as you know, the Constitution is drafted in majestic generalities, and there are ambiguous phrases like due process of law and equal protection of the law, and no one knows exactly what it means.
Isn't that precisely why? Well, see, from my standpoint, that's precisely why this is why I call it window dressing, because the way the founders wrote the Constitution was such that, they, as you to quote you, the majestic phrases are subject to interpretation. And by the way, if you're going to be an originalist on the Constitution, then that means that blacks are property, don't have a vote, women don't vote. And that's what the originalists were.
Yes.
I mean, wasn't that what the framers' attitude was?
Well, you take capital punishment, for example. Capital punishment is mentioned twice in the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. It's clearly authorized by the Constitution. But then there's the cruel and unusual punishments clause in the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. Now, cruel and unusual, does that mean as it was in 1791? In 1791, we hanged people for horse stealing, or is it cruel and unusual?
And tarred and feathered.
Yeah, or if you kissed your wife in public on Sunday, you went in the stocks. So the punishment would be both cruel and unusual today.
Can you imagine Carolla and I on Foothill Boulevard at the shopping center kicking our wives on Sunday?
That's right. I could see Carolla kissing his wife on Sunday, and he ought to be in the stocks. But
I got to tell you, I've thought about the stocks. The stocks, for people that don't know, were they got a sort of slot for your arms and a slot for your head, and you're bent over at the waist, and they put the bar over the top, and then they put the buckle on it, and there you stay. I imagine there had to be some version of Jimmy Kimmel from the 17 or 1800s that would come by and fart at whoever was bent over in that position, because there is no escaping. I mean, the ultimate cruel and unusual is breaking wind in front of the guy who's bent over at the waist and locked there permanently.
Well, that may well be so. You know, so the question is, what is so special about the understanding of society at the time in 1791? Because things have evolved a great deal since then. And one of the things Oliver Wendell Holmes said, it's absolutely monstrous if there's no better reason for a law than it was laid down in the time of Henry IV. So we clearly the standards of society evolve. Some of these things Scalia felt were very easy, for example, there was no wiretapping in 1789, but there was a provision, as you all know, about unreasonable searches and seizures. So that's a value that we didn't want, and the framers didn't want, the police coming into your home without a warrant. And so you transform that value to the digital age, and You could say the Constitution doesn't permit the government to wiretap or to hack or whatever without a warrant.
Well, you know, it's exactly without having some form of probable cause. And if you look, I think that it makes sense in a lot of ways to look at, I think you're absolutely correct, that what Scalia did was say, look, you have to look at the antecedents of all these things. I mean, one of the reasons that we had a revolution was to eliminate the king instituting what were then called writs of assistance, and that's kind of what the precursor to the Fourth Amendment was. As you say, you're supposed to be free in your home. They're not supposed to be able to just take your property by on the basis of who knows you or who doesn't know you. You're not, you know, if you wanted to know the truth, the framers would have been horrified by the idea of forfeiture actions that the government regularly uses today.
Well, they did say in the Fifth Amendment that they have to give you just compensation, but we can debate forever what just compensation is.
Compensation means, right.
So Jim, what's your sort of global overall view of where we're going, what we should be doing versus what we are doing?
Well, there are two aspects. The first is how these justices get there. And it's interesting that the liberal-conservative breakdown, it's hard to define what is a liberal and what's a conservative. And you both might think of yourselves either as liberals or conservatives, and others who know you might disagree, having heard your political views. But the fact is, those that we categorize as liberals, it just so happens we're all appointed by Democratic presidents. And those that we categorize as conservatives, it just so happens we're appointed by Republican presidents. And the Republican presidents who appointed them expected a certain type of judicial approach. Now, during the campaign, Trump said he wanted to appoint justices who would automatically overrule Roe v. Wade. Now, Gorsuch does not seem, based on the confirmation hearings, that he's a justice who would automatically overrule Roe v. Wade. But he very may well, based on a thesis he wrote and other statements he's made, be someone who is extremely pro-life. And so he may want to erode Roe v. Wade. He may side with Clarence Thomas, who wants to overrule it. He may side with Alito or Roberts, who may want to overrule it as well.
And do you analyze at all the personal dynamic on the court itself? Because, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting in the later years of Scalia was the relationship he had with Elena Kagan. And, you know, that was a symbiotic relationship in the sense that Elena Kagan, who I don't think had ever hunted in her life, Scalia ended up taking her hunting, and she ended up doing various other personal activities with him. And then you started to notice, you know, beginning with Crawford and some, actually Crawford was always one of his kind of pet peeves that you had to be able to confront and be able to cross-examine people. But she started to get, I think, Scalia to become a lot more strong and entrenched when it came to the criminal defense and the individual liberties. And a lot of people have attributed that to the relationship with Kagan. Do you talk about that?
Do you think that
plays a part?
It's also consistent with his originalist and with his textualist approach. Now, a friend of mine, David Dorson, has written a marvelous book called The Liberal Opinions of the Unexpected Scalia. He analyzes 900 opinions that he wrote, and 15% of them, mostly in the criminal justice area, could be categorized as liberal, with liberal outcomes.
Right.
And then you look at a contrast between Thomas and Scalia, because it's generally thought that Thomas and Scalia voted in lockstep, and they were both rock-ribbed conservatives. But actually, in the 97 cases where they sat together, they parted company in just about half of those cases, in 48 of the 97 cases. So the question really, if you're looking at Gorsuch and you're saying, what is Gorsuch going to be like, which no one clearly knows, is he going to be more like Thomas or more like Scalia? Everyone expecting that because of the very favorable comments he's made about Scalia, that it'll be kind of a Scalia clone.
You know, I would probably say that he's going to be more of a cross between Roberts and Scalia. I think that if you look at some of the lectures Gorsuch has given, Adam and I have talked about this, he goes and there's a YouTube video of Gorsuch speaking to the Federalist Society, talking about how the criminal law has gotten to the point where the 18 USC, the United States Code, is populated with more crimes than you can imagine, and that it's completely come down to the discretion of U.S. attorneys as to who can get charged and for what. And that is, to some degree, something that's echoed also by Roberts as well. I mean, there's a little bit of distrust of the Justice Department having all of this discretion, basically at the expense of the judiciary.
Yes, well, but it's also consistent with textualism, because it's very basic to our system that you can't have a punishment without a statute making conduct a crime on the books before the act is committed. And they both believe, Scalia believed, and I think Gorsuch as well, and Roberts, in the rule of lenity, that if it's not clear from the language of the statute, not necessarily what was intended by Congress, but the language of the statute, that something is criminal, that the conduct is criminal, then you have to excuse it because the statute does not make it illegal.
Hey, let me tease for a second. Okay. We'll get to the listener's benefit in 1 second. Mm-hmm. First, we got to benefit this show with a little Simply Safe.
Yeah, you're going to benefit the show first, but that's also a benefit for the listeners.
Well, that's true. Entry sensors, motion sensors, glass-breaking sensors make your home a burglar's worst nightmare in under an hour, pre-programmed to work right out of the box. Just plug in the base unit. So I have Simply Safe. You plug in the base unit, and then it'll talk you right through the rest of the process. Peel and stick for all the sensors and everything. No pulling wires, no drilling holes, no making a mess. Entire system is wireless. No need to make a mess and get under the house or climb around in the attic. There's some people on a slab and they have no place, no crawl space, man. Month to month, no long-term contracts, no hidden fees. Just $14.99 a month for 24/7 professional monitoring and emergency dispatch service. So don't wait another day. Go to Simply Safe, two I's, S-I-M-P-L-I, Simply Safe Adam. .com. Get 10% off your entire security system. Simply Safe, Adam. Get the 10% off. Sorry, Mark. Go ahead.
That's okay. I was going to say, for the listeners' benefit, the rule of lenity, I always explain it to jurors if there's a it's kind of a first cousin in a bizarre way of reasonable doubt. The tie goes to the runner, meaning the defendant gets the benefit of the doubt in a legal sense if there's two reasonable interpretations, and you could go either way. And, Jim, I was going to ask you, you know, Adam is a former federal prosecutor, will want to know the answer to this.
No, you don't bring that into my courtroom.
Yeah.
I'll make short work out of it.
Were you in the Manhattan DA's office, or were you at the U.S. Attorney's office?
I was in the U.S. Attorney's office under Morgenthau.
I served
with Adam.
Yeah. Jimbo and I had many a three martini lunch. I won't get into right now. Some good days.
Just before summation.
So, look at that, Adam. There's two former federal prosecutors sitting in the studio as we speak.
Oh, man. I pity the fool who comes into the studio right now. We'll make short work of them. So what is as far as the Supreme Court and Gorsuch, what do you think the first order of business is going to be when he, you know, dons the robe and takes his place?
Well, he's donned the robe, and they had oral argument, I think, 2 days ago, and they heard argument, among other things, on the religious freedom case, which is one of these core issues. I mean, we all believe that no one should be able to impose their religious beliefs on anybody else, but one of the issues is the relationship between church and state, and the question whether in exercising my religious belief I can unlawfully discriminate. So if I'm one of the cases coming up is a baker who refuses to cater a gay wedding. And
right.
He says his religion is opposes that.
I think we've discussed that, or at least
right.
a version of that, because there's multiple, I think, cases. This was a couple in, I don't know, in Oregon or something, and or maybe that's a separate case. But the same thing applies. The couple came in,
issue.
Wanted him to bake a cake for the wedding. They said no, and now here we are in front of the Supreme Court.
I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake, so he didn't want to do it.
Now, I have a thought on this that it would be, it ends up being like you were talking about at the beginning. You said, well, now you have an opinion that you don't think is right-wing, and you don't think it's conservative, but if I say it, it'll be interpreted that way, which is, when you have a business, you're allowed to do what you want to do. No shirt, no shoes, no service. That's fine. But then as a public, we're allowed to not frequent your business and possibly hurt your bottom line. That's kind of my thing, is just go across the street or open a bakery that just caters to gay couples and let them do lights out business.
A gay bakery.
Well, a gay bakery.
Right. Why can't you have a rainbow bakery? Yeah.
But well, that's what I think. But then that would be very conservative.
Yes.
Well, I don't look at it as conservative,
well,
but actually, I guess it is.
Mark, remember this. He had a Scalia opinion years ago where an Indian was indicted for possession of peyote. A Native American.
Right.
And he said, well, I'm being prosecuted, and this is infringing on the exercise of my religious belief. And Scalia wrote an opinion saying you can't make yourself a law of one, and a law of general application, like the narcotics laws, you're not excused from compliance with it because you say you're exercising your religion. I wonder whether he would say that principle applies today to the baker, because, of course, Scalia was a staunch opponent of homosexual rights, and he thought that Texas was within its bounds.
Oh, got that. What was it, the Bowers case?
Well, first of all, Bowers case said that the state could constitutionally outlaw consensual sodomy. Then, I don't know, 17 years later in Lawrence v. Texas, they changed their position and they said it violated equal protection because of the Texas statute. So they overruled themselves. And that's
And you're absolutely right. It was within the span of 20 years. And that proves, I think, probably the thesis of your book, or at least part of the thesis of the book, not having read it, I confess, but I will read it tonight, that the makeup of the court determines to some degree the very same issue that you frame even within two decades.
What do you guys think about this? Or
7 years in the abortion context, yeah.
How big a difference would this be to you guys if you're sitting on the Supreme Court? The guy or the couple who own the bakery, they say, there's two separate categories. One is we're deeply religious people. We're Christians. And we can back it up. There's a picture of us at church every single Sunday for the last 20 years. And, I got a pocket Bible on me, and this is just my belief. Versus, I don't like gay people, so I don't want to bake for them. I'm an atheist who doesn't like gay people, so I don't want to bake for them. Is there a distinction between those two at the same bakery if you're making a ruling and you're on the Supreme Court?
You tease that, Adam, because all of this talk about fresh, high-quality ingredients, that gives me a perfect segue to Blue Apron. Did you know that?
I love these guys.
I know, so do I. Fresh, high-quality ingredients, less than $10 a meal, new recipes created each week, and are not repeated within a year. I mean, can you imagine you and I doing a podcast and we don't repeat ourselves in a year? It takes 40 minutes or less. Upcoming meals, spinach and mozzarella pizza with olive pepper and ricotta salad. God, I want that right now. Parmesan-crusted chicken with creamy fettuccine. You had that, right, Adam? Didn't Olga make that?
She does it all. And the thing about Blue Apron is you bring it home, you open the box, and there's a glossy picture of what it's going to look like on your plate, and it looks exactly that way, unlike those inflatable girlfriends I got back in the day. Totally different model on the box.
Sweet and sour salmon, delivery options that fit your needs, no weekly commitments. We're not into commitments here. And so only get the deliveries you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping. BlueApron.com/doubt. That's BlueApron.com/doubt. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So,
take it away.
I'll put it to you guys. Would if you were on the Supreme Court, would you make a distinction between the deeply religious couple and the couple that said, I don't like gay people and I'm an atheist?
Well, I personally would not, because I think if you do not base it on the exercise of religion, clearly you're discriminating. And what you're doing is illegal, and it's a law of general application. No one must discriminate against gay people.
So the
but if it's couched in a religious belief, then you have the tension between two elements of the Constitution. One is the freedom of religion, and the second is the equal protection of the laws. And how you come down on
that. I have a question for you, Jim. Yeah. What do you think about, given that same thing that Adam just posed, which is really kind of reminiscent of the travel ban orders, where they were taking the statements and saying this was that Trump really didn't mean it, that this was Rudy Giuliani's way to disguise a Muslim travel ban. How would you rule if you were taking a look at either the case out of Washington or the case out of Hawaii?
Well, I believe the travel ban, the initial travel ban, was clearly unconstitutional because it didn't provide for notice or hearing before they revoked visas. The thing was ill thought through. It was a very unfortunate executive order. No one except Alan Dershowitz ever thought that they would revoke the executive order and put out a new executive order because they thought Trump's ego was such that he would never admit he was wrong. Well, he did admit he was wrong, and there was a new order, but then the White House stupidly said the new order is the policy of the old order. As soon as you say that, and you say, well, all right, we're going to give notice in a hearing, but we are going to ban Muslims or people from Muslim countries, then it violates the equal protection of the laws, and it's unconstitutional. And I think the Hawaii court ruled correctly. I think the Ninth Circuit ruled correctly. And as
yes,
I say,
what do you think? Did you read Kaczynski's, a screed on why they shouldn't have considered the statements that were outside, from his standpoint, the statements that weren't before the court or that the local state's attorneys general submitted to the court?
I think he's dead wrong, because I think that it's evidence of animus. And what he said during the campaign, what his proxy Rudy Giuliani said during the campaign, what was said even after election as to what the purpose was, and the purpose is obvious on the face of the order, that there's something more dangerous about these seven majority Muslim countries than any other country in the world.
What do you
so
guys...
Then, yes, then does the question become, though... Does it also prove your thesis? Because Kaczynski, usually on the Ninth Circuit, because he's regarded, even though he's probably in the Scalia mold, he's usually regarded as a conservative. But if you got a fifth justice like Gorsuch on the U.S. Supreme Court and it went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, that they would rule 5-4 and reverse the district courts?
I don't think so. I think even Gorsuch would, because you have Supreme Court precedent. Gorsuch said he would look to precedent. And certainly in the Guantanamo cases, and which are an outgrowth of the old Japanese internment cases, Korematsu, which was one of the darkest days in the history of the Supreme Court, where they imprisoned people of Japanese descent simply because of, even though they were native-born Americans, simply because of their racial and ethnic background.
The great George Takei will always correct you if you say Japanese internment camp. He says Japanese-American internment camp, meaning, let's not forget, there's war, but these are American citizens.
Well, that's quite right. And there was no in fact, the government lied as to whether they were in touch with the Japanese government in Tokyo and whether they were fifth columnists in America. It's a very dark day in the history of our country and in the history of the Supreme Court. But the outgrowth of that is the Supreme Court became increasingly wary of claims by the executive that something was necessary in the interests of national security, and they were willing to test it. And not say, well, this is a political decision and it's for the executive branch of government. We saw that in the Guantanamo cases, where more and more they refused to allow Congress to abolish the writ of habeas corpus. They said that prisoners in Guantanamo were entitled to a hearing after some period of time, and on. So an outgrowth of that is that certainly the Supreme Court is going to give strict scrutiny to Trump's claims that national security is necessary in order to discriminate against people on the basis of their religion.
So where do you think Gorsuch comes down on the bakery and the gay client?
Well, I know.
And the Supreme Court.
Well, I think Gorsuch has a record of coming down on the side of religion and the free exercise of religion. And whether we disagree with the beliefs of any particular religion, as long as the beliefs are plausible, and they don't even look at how plausible they are, but coming down on that side. And you have this case that came up, that was argued, which involved the church in Missouri, and state funds were generally available to schools to put rubberized floors in playgrounds because they thought it would avoid injuries to to youngsters. And however, the state refused to grant money to a Lutheran church because they said this was funding a religion. And they wouldn't do it. So the question was, does that interfere with the free exercise of religion? And the court appeared to agree with the church, and Gorsuch appeared to agree with the church in the oral argument. What's interesting is the other justices did not want to seem to leave Gorsuch hanging out there to dry, with a 5-4 majority decision on the side of the church. So you had justices like Breyer and justices like Kagan raising the question of how different is this from the state providing police protection, security for a church, or if the church has a fire, sending the fire department to put out the fire, and clearly that's constitutional. And how is this different? Because youngster who's injured in the playground, whether the youngster is pious or religious, it's still a member of the population being injured, and shouldn't the state provide funds to make it a safer environment?
Would you guys make a distinction then between things that were religious? There's a religious institution, this church, but the padding on the floor, there's nothing in the Bible about padding on the floor. You know, there is stuff about gay relationships, for instance. So would you guys make a distinction between religious and religious stuff that sort of applies or is apparent, meaning religious stuff that is involves the religion and religious stuff that involves flooring?
Well, there's separate issues in my mind, because one involves funding for religious institutions, which is unconstitutional because it is preferring one religion over another. And they had a case from which Locke, from which Scalia dissented, where the state was providing scholarship money in, I think, Washington State for the education of students who wanted to go into the ministry. And so that was using state funds for religious purpose. And the majority held that was unconstitutional. Now, the issue is, isn't there a special purpose involved where you have a playground and where the church is really performing something like a secular-like function, namely providing playground facilities for students?
I have a question for both of you to tease here before we jump in. I'm curious on what your thoughts are for the tax exemptions for religious institutions, because that seems
That's so funny you say that, Adam, because that's exactly where I wanted to head.
Well, that's a straight
federal problem.
Yes,
right.
Your phone's cracking up a little there, Mark. But hold on a second. That to me is as straight a line as you get between the government and the church. Not requiring that they pay their fair share in taxes. First, I'll tell you about Rich Uncles. RichUncles.com. Oh, man, I'm a big fan of Rich Uncles. I've invested with them. Their REITs, their Real Estate Investment Trust, Getting cash dividends. Lots of listeners have, too. And here's how rich uncles work. They're smart. Well, that's interesting. I've never even seen this one. Oh, here we go. Rich uncles. They're checking for interest in proposed REIT. That's a REIT. That's a real estate investment trust for student housing. So here's how student housing works. Parents pay for it. That's simple. Rich uncles plan on buying facilities for students at major colleges and universities. Sounds interesting. They never stop expanding, these rich uncles guys. So you can go to richuncles.com. Express your interest in the REIT. Rich Uncles Student Housing REIT, a Reggae Tier 2 offering. That's richuncles.com, or give them a call, 855-RICH-UNCLES. Look, you put your money in the bank, you get 0.5% back. You go with Rich Uncles, you get a nice return. So richuncles.com. All right, sorry.
Rich Uncle Student Housing REIT is seeking indications of interest concerning its Reg A Tier 2 securities offering. Any indication of interest involves no obligation or commitment of any kind. No money or other consideration is being solicited, and if sent in response will not be accepted. No sales will be made or commitments to purchase accepted until the offering statement is qualified. This media outlet is being paid under $15,000 by Rich Uncles for this single message.
All right, now we're ready to go. The question is, what about the church and the state, and then places like Scientology calling themselves a religion and getting the benefits from the government of being a religion? How do you guys come down on that?
Well, Mark, over to you. How do you come down on it?
Well, I was gonna say, when you talk about the case where the peyote case, that you could then, I always think, and the most recent one, what was the one out of Arkansas where the guy had the beard, the Muslim who had the beard in prison, and they ruled that that was, when the prison authorities wanted him to shave, and the Supreme Court said, no, you didn't have to. And I think Alito actually came down and said, no, he didn't have to. It was the exercise of his religion. It's almost like their definition of pornography, that they'll know religion when they see it. And so as long as you're giving that exemption to the right number of, or to everyone, or it's not being parsed out too harshly, I think that probably stands or passes muster constitutionally.
Well, how do you feel about it personally?
Well, personally.
He'll call back. He's having trouble with his line. But yeah, I'm curious, Jim. How do you feel about it personally?
Well, I think personally, I believe that the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion, is not limited to preferring one religion over another, but rather it means there should be a separation generally between church and state. Now, that's subject to many qualifications, and I think one of the qualifications might be the case of school playground, where the state is really supplying services for the special purpose of a religious institution that protects public safety. And there may be other examples. Clearly, the fire department, the police department, going to put out some emergency at a church, that's fine.
But for something like Scientology...
Then you get people in the Scalia-Alito mold who say you have to, and even Roberts, have to say that you have to accept the tenet of the religion, however implausible. Now, you look at the Hobby Lobby case where people said a privately owned corporation, it was an arts and crafts a chain, said that it was owned by people of a certain religious faith that was opposed to abortion. And they said that they weren't opposed to contraception, they were opposed to abortion, but they said that certain contraceptive devices that were supplied under Obamacare, like the IUD and other things, were really abortifacients, like the morning after pill, because they terminated a fertilized egg rather than preventing the fertilization. That's the distinction between abortion and contraception. And the court, and the majority of the court said that you had to accept that as their religious belief, no matter how implausible. Now, the burden they claimed on the religion was that under Obamacare, if they simply filed a notice with the insurance company that they didn't want to provide this service, the insurance company would provide it or the government would provide it. And they said sending the notice was a burden on their religion. Now, it seems to me that's patently absurd. I mean, how could it burden your exercise of your religion to send a notice to the insurance company or the government?
And, well, that seems like they're just making a statement.
Making a statement. Five justices of the Supreme Court agreed with that.
So how did the Hobby Lobby thing come down? And Mark, are you back on? Gary, you... There he is. Yes. Yeah. Because the thing about a lot of these cases from somebody who don't follow them as closely as you is you hear about them, you hear nothing but them, and then it goes away.
Yeah.
I think your phone's going off. Really, the gods are conspiring against us with the phone department today. But so what happens is we hear about it for 2 days straight, and it's wall-to-wall Hobby Lobby, and then 2 years goes by, and we have no idea what happened. And that's just kind of how our news cycle works. So how did it end up?
Well, it ended up where Hobby Lobby was sustained 5-4, and yeah. Gorsuch in the lower court took the same position that was taken by the Supreme Court majority.
So
basically saying religious belief trumps other provisions of the Constitution.
So Hobby Lobby won, so to speak.
Yes, that's right.
So
yeah, Hobby Lobby won and is the law of the land.
Wouldn't you then suspect that the gay couple in the bakery is just going to go the same direction? Haven't they already sort of spoken on this?
Predicted, if I were laying odds, what would you say, Jim? I'd say 5-4.
I'd say 5-4. They'll say that in the exercise of his religion, he doesn't have to cater the wedding. And
well, they already did it with Hobby Lobby, right?
Did it with Hobby Lobby. It's good.
Same thing.
Good law. Good precedent for it.
Yeah, and Gorsuch was not in, but that's the way he went. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, no, I was just going to say, speaking of five, LegalZoom, five things you can count on from LegalZoom for your estate plan, how's that one?
That's smooth.
Well, that's how the law is something that should be relied on and shouldn't depend on the whims and caprices of who's on the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, the Constitution is what, for better or for worse, the Constitution is what the judges say it is. And Justice Jackson said, we're not final because we're infallible. We're infallible because we're final.
Mark, your intro LegalZoom. Sorry, it's been a long morning. was so smooth. Jim didn't even know you were going into it.
That's because it's five things you can count on: five votes at the U.S. Supreme Court, five things you can count on from LegalZoom for your estate plan, and reliability. For 50-plus more millions have trusted LegalZoom for wills, living trusts, and more. Isn't that amazing, 15 million people? Guidance, just like what you want from the Supreme Court. You'll work with an independent attorney to create a plan that fits your needs. Flexibility, it's easy to make updates as your family grows or when you buy a new home. Helpful support, the right people standing by for questions, all based in the U.S., just like the clerks do for the Justice of the Supreme Court. No surprises, just like Jim and I are predicting it's going to be 5-4. LegalZoom isn't a law firm, so no charge by the hour because we hate the billable hour here at Reasonable Doubt. Complete transparency and upfront pricing. Gary?
Do the right thing for you and your family by setting up your estate plan with LegalZoom today, and don't forget to enter DOUBT at checkout to save even more. LegalZoom.com. Enter DOUBT. LegalZoom.com.
All right. So what is can you give us, Jim, a day in the life of a Supreme Court judge? Because I don't know. Do they get up and punch in at 9 a.m. and punch out at 5 p.m.? Are they working every single day? Is there always some plate that they're spinning, or are there periods where there's nothing to wrestle over.
Well, some days Justice Scalia liked to hunt quail. Some days Justice Stevens liked to play golf. Some days they may want to stay home with their families or go to the park. Holmes and Brandeis like to take a walk together in the park outside the Supreme Court. There wasn't the security concern there is today. And in fact, it's said that when Holmes was 90, a very attractive woman walked by, and his wife had already had predeceased him, had already died, and he turned to Brandeis and said, "Ah, Louis, if I were only 80.
So there's not work to be done every day.
There's not work to be done every day. I suppose they would say they're thinking about the problem every day.
Right.
Whatever it is.
That's what my father used to tell me when he was taking naps in the office. I'm thinking on various levels.
On various levels. But also, you know, they're taking fewer cases than they used to take. And
right, and there's got, and people don't understand. They literally take a summer vacation. It's the first week of October until the first week of October.
So, Jim, would it be your belief that if we ever had a run of Republican presidents that just went on for 20 years, or a run of Democratic presidents that went on for some substantial period of time, just, you know, Obama and then right into Hillary Clinton and then who knows coming up the road, but they just kept going, that the Supreme Court would just start changing and eventually lean that direction pretty severely?
Well, undoubtedly, the president's choices would influence the direction of the court. But we may not need to wait for a run of Republican presidents, because in the next 2 years or 4 years, Trump may be able to appoint as many as two or three additional justices to the court, depending on the vicissitudes of retirement or resignation or death among the justices. Now, he has pledged to appoint anti-abortion rights and possibly anti-gay rights justices, certainly justices who would be interested in, and this is what is so frightening, be interested in reversing the trend of the last 40 to 50 years in constitutional jurisprudence in which personal liberties have been guaranteed in decisions of the Supreme Court.
Do you feel, though, I have a thought. Mark's still with us?
I am.
I'm interested in what you guys think about this. So we have Trump. And Trump has said he's cracking down on immigration, illegal immigration. And he wants to build a wall. He wants to do that. And L.A. and New York and Chicago and many other cities went, screw you. We're going to be a sanctuary city. We're not going to force your laws. If the Supreme Court said, you know, down the road after, let's just say, Trump gets another guy in there who's on his side and they're anti-gay and anti abortion and so on and so forth, and he said, okay, now here's the new law of the land. Abortion's illegal. Don't you feel like the sanctuary cities would just go, no, we're going to continue to provide this?
Well, I'll tell you this. As we're taping this today, the new Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has sent out letters to various California sanctuary cities telling them that they need to report on compliance with immigration reporting, otherwise they're going to lose their federal grants. So there's going to always, at least with this administration, I think that there's always going to be that hammer that if you want to do it, you know, you do it at your own peril. Adam, you may remember back in the day, they did this with speed limits, and they also have done it more recently, in the last couple of decades, with the blood alcohol levels for driving under the influence. So when they threaten the federal money, that's the hammer that's used.
Interesting. Oh, yeah. But it's weird because I have this theory, and maybe I'm incorrect, but I have this theory that if they made abortion illegal, you'd still be able to get an abortion in Los Angeles because Los Angeles would go, we're still going to provide this, regardless of whether you cut off the funding or not.
Well, but that's a pretty good point. I'd love to hear what Jim's take on this. I mean, the people who are generally considered to be on the right are also the biggest proponents of states' rights, or traditionally have been. And if it's states' rights and you want to leave the states to make these decisions, then why isn't that okay for abortion? Why isn't that okay for marijuana? Why are we federalizing those issues?
Well, the majority of states now permit some form of abortion. In fact, they have to permit certainly abortion in the first trimester. Both Scalia and Trump have said this is a matter that should be left to the states. So if a state wanted to ban abortion, if they overruled Roe v. Wade, that would be constitutional. If a state wanted to further burden a woman's constitutional right to an abortion, if the five justices agreed, that would be constitutional. So that would be a further retraction of abortion rights as established in Roe v. Wade and in the Casey case.
So
it would vary from state to state. And the unfortunate thing is that in many of these states, like Texas and Alabama and many of the southern states, which take a dim view of abortion rights, the people who need it most, who are poor women who can't afford to travel to Los Angeles to get an abortion, would be denied that, and either their health would be jeopardized or economically they would be terribly disadvantaged because they would have to raise unwanted children.
I'm confused about one point. If Trump says he wants to get a Supreme Court judge in there who's going to be against abortion, but he also says he'd leave it up to the states, aren't those two ideas sort of bumping into each other?
He said who would overrule Roe v. Wade. That would simply mean there's no uniform national rule on abortion and it would be left to the states. So state even Scalia said this is up to the people of the states and their legislatures. So if a state wanted to legalize abortion, that's fine. If they wanted to ban abortion, that's fine.
I just feel like it would be almost suicide for the state to make that proclamation or to go that direction.
Oh, I'm not sure it would be suicide in Texas or Alabama or South Carolina.
Right.
Well, there's always
or Arkansas. I mean, I think it would be suicide in California or New York.
In California.
Yeah, yeah, what do you guys think?
Remember,
I mean,
Alabama produced Jeff Sessions and Roy Moore.
Do you think where do you think, and maybe this is me just living in Los Angeles my entire life and being jaded or not from this, you know, going back and forth to San Francisco and Los Angeles and thinking
too much driving a car. Though.
Yeah, who would ban this? But what do you guys think if they said we'll leave it state to state percentage wise? We won't get into numbers or states, but if you give it some thought, I'll tease it. You go state to state. What percentage do you think we're left with that are going to say we're going to make it illegal versus no problemo? Maybe Alabama and California are easy. That's an easy decision to make, one for one.
I think there's a reason that abortion is a wedge issue, don't you, Jim? And that would be, it's probably a red-blue divide.
Well, hold on. Don't step on it. Let me tell you this. But you guys both sort of think of a number, like, you know, 60% would ban it, or 50% or 40% wouldn't, or whatever. Think of a number. I'll give you a little time. I'll tell you about Books, Mother's Day flowers, man. Don't get lured into the $19.99 advertised price and then the checkout at $94. Let's not do that. That's right up there with the carpet cleaning flyer. Remember to get those things? We'll clean any three rooms for $14. And you think, how's that possible? And then you realize it's not possible. Books, it's a better way to buy flowers. Fully transparent pricing, easy shopping experience, incredible selection. I had the guy in here who started this company. He was on Shark Tank.
I didn't know that, really.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy, and he's a really smart guy. And the sharks turned their back on the Books, but Robert Herjavec ended up going to this guy for his wedding because he got a quote for his wedding for $100,000. And the Books did it for half, so now they're back. Anyway, starting at $40, including a free free delivery. You get a beautiful, incredible selection. And it's done from a sustainably farmed farm. So it's responsible, straight from the grower to the customer. So they last longer. They cost less. Got a special offer for our listeners right now. You get 20% off. Just visit Bouqs, B-O-U-Q-S, Bouqs.com. Enter Doubt. Get 20% off your Mother's Day purchase. That's Bouqs, B-O-U-Q-S.com. Enter the promo code Doubt. All right, guys, do we have a number of states, or not a number of states, a percentage of this country that would say make abortions illegal?
Well, the states, a number of states would be more meaningful because the states would enact laws. But I think probably 40% of the states would in some way regulate abortion or modify abortion. And some might outright ban abortion, but certainly regulate abortion to a greater degree than it is in Los Angeles
or New York. So up to 40%?
Yeah, I would think.
Would make a move.
It would be a guess. I don't know. How do you feel, Mark?
I think it would probably be higher because I think when you take a look at the map, the voting map for presidential elections, red versus blue, generally there's fewer blue states because they're more heavily populated. And so I think you'd see a lot more states that would regulate. I mean, you could go through and tick them off. Kansas, Nebraska, Idaho, Alabama, Georgia. I mean, I think there's a Florida, I think, would be a toss-up. But there are quite a few states that I think would come and regulate or enhance the current regulations.
So then you've touched on an issue that really is quite significant, and that is how these justices may shift in their ideology once they're on the court. They're there for life. They're independent of either Congress or the executive branch or even the so-called will of the people. So they have to be independent enough to come down with unpopular decisions. Now, you look at Roe v. Wade, which came down in 1973. It's been 44 years, and I think is largely won public support across all the states. Now, three Nixon-appointed Republican justices concurred in that decision. It was a 6-3 decision. It would not have been possible without the votes of Powell and Blackmun and Berger, Nixon appointees. And Berger later said that he was personally against abortion. He thought it was horrible. And a lot of people would submit that it is horrible, even people who support abortion rights. But he said he felt the Constitution required it. And that, as Kennedy later said, there have to be certain decisions that the Constitution takes away from political vicissitude.
It's interesting that the judge in the case was anti-abortion but still voted with a thumbs up, and the subject of Roe v. Wade ended up later on becoming like a born-again Christian and against abortion. They both kind of ended up going a different direction than where their final place was. So is this yes?
That's such an astute observation because, you know, you take a look at, I mean, some of these things are so unpredictable. You look at David Souter, who retired from the U.S. Supreme Court and was appointed, that was, a George Herbert Walker Bush
That's
appointee, right? And he ended up becoming considered part of the liberal wing, if you will, and Bush later commented that he regretted that appointment. Yeah, a lot of times you just never know it. I mean, look at Roberts. Roberts upheld Obama. Was the defining vote in the Obamacare decision. So sometimes you just don't know. And I mean, Kennedy as a swing vote is another example of it doesn't exactly predict, or it's not predictive.
Well, and Kennedy has been a swing voter, and he's voted with the majority in 98% of the cases in which he's participated. Now, there are some stories out there that Kennedy may retire this summer, in which case he might be replaced by a rock-rib conservative who will not be a swing voter. And that would certainly change the balance and dimension of the court.
But at least, you know, there's a lot of precedent for guys and girls getting vote, you know, becoming Supreme Court justices and then just being autonomous. But voting the way they believe the case, even against their own personal beliefs or against the beliefs of the person who put them in that position, who nominated them.
Yes. Well, that certainly that issue certainly arose with Earl Warren, who was a Republican and come from the political branches of government. All but one of the current Supreme Court justices were formerly lower court federal judges, circuit court judges. Earl Warren changed. William Brennan appointed by Warren, by Eisenhower, because Eisenhower wanted a Catholic on the bench and thought he'd be an anti-abortion vote. He turned out to vote with the majority in Roe v. Wade and later said, when asked about the conflict between his religion and his vote in Roe v. Wade, he said he never gave it a thought.
How come this, as we come to the end of our hour here, how come this doesn't come up more often, this subject? You know, when you watch the news, it's obviously so black and white. If this person gets in, this is how they're going to vote. And if that person gets in, that's how they're going to vote. But you have all these examples of guys and girls getting, I don't mean girls, but, you know, and men and women coming in, mostly men, who didn't vote the way predicted or as maybe sometimes feared.
Well, yes. Jim, wouldn't you agree? Wizard White, Byron White, appointed by Kennedy.
He's the only one you could name who was appointed by a Democratic president who then took a conservative position on the court. You're absolutely right. A number of the Republican justices, even Potter Stewart or Lewis Powell, who were moderates, often voted with the liberals in many cases. What has to be stressed is that you can't really predict the way they'll go in every case. But there is a core of ideologically freighted cases that I'd like to say guns, gays, God, and abortion, where you can do that and where they have voted in lockstep that way in accordance with ideology and not necessarily with what the law dictates.
Right. And who was it who famously said the Supreme Court reads election returns?
Yes. Well, I have that quote in the book because it was done by a comedian named Finley Dunn. And he said the Supreme Court follows the election returns.
Is it fair to say, well, I don't want to put any words in anyone's mouth, but is it more likely, at least from precedent and historically, that a conservative judge lean or vote on a progressive issue with a, you know, thumbs up versus a progressive judge give a thumbs up to a conservative issue? Because it seems like I've heard a few examples of guys that we thought were conservative still going a more progressive route.
I'd be interested to hear what Jim says on this. I would say that the one area where you see progressive judges or what are considered left judges voting conservatively is law and order or criminal justice issues. But other than that, I think Jim is spot on when he says Wizard White or Byron White was one of the few examples in the other way.
I would agree with that. And ironically, one of the judges who voted with criminal defendants consistently where there was an issue was Antonin Scalia. And you've mentioned,
correct,
Mark, the Confrontation Clause cases. There were also, it was the Stale case case involving DNA, where they, before they even arrested the guy, they took a DNA swab, and he was arrested for a traffic violation, I think. And then they ran the DNA test, and they found that 12 years before, he was a suspect in a rape case. And then they arrested him, charged him with rape. So, and Scalia said, well, that was illegal under the Fourth Amendment because it was so far-fetched that they, before arrest, that they could take the DNA swab.
Didn't he say at one point something with the effect that he should be the poster child or the pin-up girl for the criminal defense bar?
Yes, certainly Fourth Amendment cases, he voted that way. And the Confrontation Clause cases, his Confrontation Clause jurisprudence, I really didn't understand because there was, for example, a statute in Maryland where they said in a child molestation case, the child, rather than enduring the trauma of being confronted with the defendant who allegedly abused him, that the child could testify in closed-circuit television and then be cross-examined on closed-circuit television. And Scalia said, no, that's unconstitutional. Fortunately, he was in the minority. But he said, because confrontation requires actual confrontation, not virtual confrontation.
Supremely Partisan is the name of the book, How Raw Politics Tips the Scales in the United States Supreme Court. It's available at Amazon now. Jim Zirin, very interesting stuff. I didn't think we could do a whole hour on the Supreme Court, but we did, and I was...
We could do another episode. Jim, would you, if you've got a book with you, will you autograph it for me and leave it with Gary?
I certainly... Well, the only book I see here is the one in the studio, I'd be happy to autograph it.
I'll get it. Oh, by the way, is there an audio version of this book?
It's on Kindle. I don't know whether there's an audio version yet, but
gotta look into that.
I'll have to talk to my publisher about it, because I discovered here in California there are a lot of drivers. So
yeah, and a fair bit of traffic as well. All right, you can go to adamcarolla.com if you want to know about any of the upcoming shows or Corolla drinks or the 24-hour war or whatever it is. Oh, yeah, no audio. We need to get an audio, and we should talk to your publisher about that, because we do those here. Check out me and Dennis Prager, No Safe Spaces. It's available now on iTunes and Amazon and adamcarolla.com. Just $4.99, about 100 minutes. Mark, what do you got?
Got the Palm Springs this weekend. Coachella probably sold out, but you can probably get it next week. Got Casa Tropicana in San Clemente, beautiful, right on the beach by the pier. Capri Hotel in the Hamptons opening up next month. Got 10E Mediterranean Tapas downtown. Engine Company, Comfort Food, and Prova Pizza Bar in Grand Central Station in New York City.
So I'll see you Sunday night, Mark.
Yep. You'll see me at tomorrow night when you're listening to this for Adam Schiff.
Yep. So, till next time, Adam Kroll for Mark Garagus and Jim Zirin. Zirin, sorry. Bad reader. I told you, so I need the audiobook. Jim Zirin saying, mahalo.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Tune in next Saturday for an all-new episode. This is Corolla Digital. At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night, and building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.